From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, The Roadrunner, Chuck Jones has worked with them all. Jones is the animation director responsible for many of Warner Brothers' greatest cartoons, and he's our guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with TV writer and producer Mark Frost. He's teamed up with film director David Lynch on a new series called Twin Peaks. Frost describes it as a cross between Peyton Place and Blue Velvet. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz introduces us to the work of the Soviet Union's premier woman composer. And Owen Gleiberman reviews a new documentary about the late film director John Huston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Rescuers in Northern California are going through the wreckage of Oakland's double-decker Interstate 880 in search of survivors or victims of yesterday's earthquake. The death toll has risen above 270. Authorities report 253 people died on the freeway. The quake was the second worst in U.S. history. Preliminary reports estimate the damage at more than $1 billion, prompting President Bush to order federal disaster aid to California. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details.
White House officials quickly cranked the bureaucracy into action. This morning, President Bush visited the headquarters of the Federal Emergency Management Agency and expressed hope that there would be what he called less carping than after Hurricane Hugo, when his administration was criticized for responding slowly.
But I guess you can never avoid all criticism, but FEMA then responded very promptly. And I can assure you they're responding very, very promptly now. I think they took a bad hit on that other one.
The White House will immediately use $273 million unallocated from Hugo in the Bay Area. When the money runs out, they'll ask for more for the aftermath of both disasters. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Red Cross spokeswoman Barbara Lohman says her organization is struggling to meet the demands of Northern California earthquake relief so soon after the devastation of Hurricane Hugo.
Before Hurricane Hugo struck the American possessions, U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and then came onto our mainland, we had approximately $10 million in our national disaster budget to carry us through until next June. And now we're looking at a $42 million relief effort in Hugo, and we won't know for probably a few days what it may to cost to help those victims out in San Francisco in the Bay Area.
The head of the Berkeley Seismology Station, Dr. Robert Erhammer, says the magnitude of yesterday's quake has no bearing on future tremors.
The fact that this earthquake occurred will not significantly influence the possibility of other major earthquakes and other fault systems in the Bay Area. The thing is, there's no real good evidence to imply that the occurrence of one earthquake significantly influences the occurrence of other earthquakes in the area.
Utility officials say electricity to remote areas may not be restored for days. Power won't be restored until the threat of gas leaks is eliminated. The space shuttle Atlantis finally lifted off today on its mission to send the nuclear-powered Galileo space probe to Jupiter. The $1.5 billion mission is 7 years behind schedule. The launch was the start of a voyage that will take the probe on a looping path past Venus in February. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 5 points to close at 2643.65. Advances led declines 4-3. This is NPR News. Erich Honecker resigned today as head of state in East Germany. He was forced out under growing pressure for democratic reforms. Honecker turned over power to Egon Krenz, the head of internal and external security. Honecker, who is 77, said he was giving up his leadership because of ill health. He was absent for most of this summer after gallbladder surgery. U.S. officials reacted to the ouster of Honecker by challenging his successor to embrace reforms sweeping other Eastern Bloc nations. President Bush held out the prospect of improved relations with East Germany today, but suggested it was way too early to say whether the power shuffle could pave the way. In the past 2 days, there's been unusually harsh language between the U.S. and Israel. It results from a disagreement over how to get Israel's own peace plan moving. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In a speech yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Itzhak Shamir complained that the U.S. was pressuring Israel to meet with the PLO and to give up occupied land in exchange for a peace settlement. Shamir refuses to do either. We do not want a confrontation with the United States, he said, but we will not give in. And he said, we are still standing firm against the whole world, his words. Today, State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler responded.
The statement he made yesterday was unhelpful, and we're disappointed. We're not looking for a fight or confrontation with Israel. Our only purpose is to help the government of Israel advance its own peace initiative.
Secretary of State James Baker seems eager to put the verbal sparring behind. In a long telephone conversation with the Israeli foreign minister today, Secretary Baker discussed the peace process without mentioning Mr. Shamir's remarks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The House Ethics Committee concluded today that Democratic Representative Jim Bates is guilty of sexually harassing two of his female staffers and approving improper campaign activity in his congressional office. The committee did not ask the House to discipline Bates. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before I introduce my guest, we want to send our best wishes to our listeners in California as you contend with the aftermath of the earthquake. My guest today is the man behind many of the Looney Tunes stars. Animation director Chuck Jones created many now classic cartoons featuring Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. He originated the characters Pepe Le Pew, the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Jones worked at Warner Brothers from 1933 until the studio closed down its cartoon division in 1963. Then he formed his own production company and created primetime TV specials, including Rikki Tikki Tavi and a Connecticut rabbit in King Arthur's Court. Jones has written an autobiography called Chuck Amuck. The title is borrowed from Duck Amuck, Jones's cartoon about cartooning. In it, Daffy Duck finds himself at the mercy of a fickle cartoonist. Daffy opens the cartoon as a brave musketeer, but the cartoonist keeps changing the scenery on him to the most inappropriate settings, a farm, the Arctic, Hawaii. The cartoonist eventually erases not only the background, but Daffy himself.
Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds? Dashing through the snow, through the fields we go, laughing all the way. Farewell to thee, farewell to thee. The wind will carry back our sad refrain. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon, and that in animated cartoons they have scenery, and in all the years I... All right, wise guy, where am I?
Chuck Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. You changed a lot of the characters who you worked with over the years.
Uh-huh.
And can you describe when you first started directing Daffy Duck, who was always my favorite? When you started directing Daffy Duck, what was he like? And then maybe you could tell us a little bit of the character changes that you brought to the
Daffy. It's a little difficult to isolate them exactly as to what I contributed, but I all the characters I felt were part of me, particularly Daffy and the Coyote, because they made the kind of mistakes that most of us make, only multiplied a bit. But Daffy was an interesting character, I think, because he would rush in and fear to tread at the same time. And he also could be fawning and overbearing at the same time. And I think that happens with very many of us when we, sometimes in the reverse, when we go in to talk to the boss and ask for a raise, we're overbearing. When we get inside, we're fawning. But Daffy is both at the same time. At the beginning, he was just crazy, as was Bugs. Even in the first great, Wild Hare that Tex Avery directed, the character was really kind of mad, more like Harpo Marx, perhaps. And I was never comfortable with a character unless I could understand him, and I can't understand crazy people. So I always try to sort of pasteurize my characters to find out who they are. The who is the whole point about character animation is not what. It isn't what a character looks like or indeed how it's drawn.
You sound like a method animator.
Well, I guess so. I don't think that I could do it unless I cared about the characters.
In your cartoon, Duck Amuck, why did you choose Daffy Duck as the character that was going to be at the whim of the cartoonist?
Well, I tried it later with Bugs Bunny and it didn't work. Fortunately, I did Duck Amuck first, then I did one called Rabbit Rampage. And he also had the same problem, and he's Yeah, the person in this case turned out to be Elmer Fudd that was moving him around. But it didn't work because that's not the kind of person that, that Bugs is. Bugs is a comic hero, you see, as compared with a comic wimp, which would go back to all the great comedians, starting with Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all the rest of them. They were, they're all kind of semi-losers, aren't they? They're more like us. But I always liked Daffy because he would continue beyond where I would stop simply because I'd be afraid of what the community would think of me. Daffy continues, so... But when I was working with him, all I had to do was reach down inside of me and bring the Daffy up to the surface and spread it out and take a look at it and see what would I do if I had Daffy Duck's courage.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Jones is my guest, and he directed many of the Warner Brothers cartoons during the heyday of the animation studio, and he directed many of the big stars like Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Porky Pig. He also created the characters Pepe Le Pew and Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. He has a new memoir called Chuck Amuck. You told us a little bit about how you changed Daffy Duck and how you drew him a little differently, different characteristics you gave him. What about Bugs Bunny? What are some of the changes you brought to Bugs's life?
Well, I think that one of the nice things about there were three units there. After 1946, all the films that Warner now owns were directed by Fritz Freleng or Bob McKimson or me. Bob Clampett left in 46 and Tex around 44. So we had these wonderful sessions. When I would get an idea for a film, or my writer and I would get an idea for a film, we'd call in the other directors and writers, and we'd sit down and have this session, which we called a yes session, which meant for 2 hours nobody could say anything negative. If you couldn't contribute to the idea, your job was to shut up. But usually the ideas were pretty good when they came in. The result of this was that we were all involved with each other's picture, although each director had absolute control of what went into his own pictures. But there was no internecine warfare. We liked each other. We wanted each other to succeed. But if I gave a great gag to Fritz Freleng and he used it, and it appeared on the screen and got an enormous laugh, I naturally wanted to go out and throw up. But because that's human nature, that's Daffy Duck in me.
When you did your recording sessions, the voice sessions with Mel Blanc, mm-hmm. what kind of suggestions would you make to him about the characteristics that he should try to be getting at through his voice?
Well, for one thing, I'd have completely laid out the picture. All the key drawings that I would be giving to the animators had already been done, and I would already have finished the exact dialogue. Mel never sat in on story things or anything like that. And in no way could we let any actor, Mel or anybody else, ad-lib, because we had to make pictures exactly to 6 minutes. So the dialogue was all carefully planned to fit into an exact 6-minute format. So when I was ready for the actor, usually Mel, about an hour before we were to record, I'd call him in. The marvel of Mel was that he was such a brilliant actor that he could immediately get the idea of what you were talking about.
All the great characters of the Warner Brothers cartoons are all animals. They're animals with the traits of people, but they're not people. They're ducks and rabbits and skunks. What are some of the advantages of using animals instead of people for the cartoons?
Well, we had ample precedents to go on. I mean, going back to Aesop's Fables and Kipling, and even Mark Twain did several things about animals, and of course Beatrix Potter and so many others, but the main thing is that it's easier to humanize animals than it is to humanize humans, and it's as you know from seeing Snow White and the Poor Princes and all the Disney films, it's very difficult to animate human beings, and when we did animate them, they didn't look very much like human beings. I mean, Elmer Fudd doesn't look any more like a human being than Bugs Bunny looks like a rabbit. Bugs is obviously not a rabbit. Rabbits look more like... And the average rabbit looks very much more like a pillow than anything else. However, I think that taking a rabbit and making him as heroic as Bugs Bunny is a lot more easy than it is to take a human being and make him like Bugs, with Bugs' characteristics.
You always believe that in a cartoon world that you have to create certain rules of the universe, and the characters always have to live within those rules. Give us an example through, say, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, because you created those characters.
Yes.
What's tell us a little bit about the universe that you created them in.
Well, there are several things that happen when in all comedy. the more you channelize, the more you narrow the your character down, the better it gets. For some reason, take Charlie Chaplin, when he once got that little costume, look how much he was restricted in what he could do. He could only be the little tramp, but he could be the little tramp and he also limited the little tramp in pretty much into living in a city. Well, we felt that when we got the Roadrunner and Coyote going, it was evident that they both lived in the southwestern American desert. And so you immediately say to yourself, that's where they live, that's where they got to live. And the fact that the Roadrunner is a Roadrunner means that he should stay on the road. And there were a number of other rules about that, that the Roadrunner can never harm the Coyote. The Coyote can only harm himself by buying those unfortunate things he gets from the Acme Corporation, so on. So that's what we, and the more rules you apply, and you never hear any other sound except the beep beep. And I found that with going back then to Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny is such a powerful character, and he's a comic hero rather than a loser. He's such a powerful character that he could become a terrible bully. So we always started Bugs in every picture. We started him in a natural rabbit environment, minding his own business, a quiet living rabbit, something like Rex Harrison, perhaps, before he got involved with My Fair Lady, ladies. And then someone comes along and tries to deprive him of his foot or his life, or he's, you know, or sending him up in a rocket or something. And then he has to fight back, you see. And when once engaged in the war, then he's happily engaged. But without that, he would just be a bully. And there were some characters like Heckle and Jekyll and even Woody Woodpecker at some time seemed to go out and just heckle people for no particular reason. Bugs never did that. And this is vital and necessary if you wanted the character to be believable and for people to care about him.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk about cartoons some more. And my guest is Chuck Jones, who directed many of the classic Warner Brothers cartoons. And he directed Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd. He created the characters of Pepe Le Pew and Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. Chuck Jones has written his autobiography. It's called Chuck Amuck, The Life and Times of an Animated Cartoonist. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chuck Jones is my guest. One of the characters you created was Pepe Le Pew, this skunk who thinks he's very debonair and quite irresistible, but he's really quite repulsive. He has no idea. And he has this great fractured French that he speaks. As a matter of fact, let me just play a little excerpt of Pepe Le Pew, and this is from a cartoon that you won an Academy Award for, Sentimental Reasons.
Quelle est? Ah, the petite femme skunk. The rendezvous, no? Ah, my darling, how beautiful you are. How lonesome it has been that I have without you. The sweet nothings. The sweet somethings. The tender enrapturements. But I forget. But of course, the rendezvous.
Why did Pepe Le Pew have to be a French skunk?
Because it's funnier that way. A Bulgarian skunk probably wouldn't have been as interesting, or any Egyptian skunk. So, I don't know, French, that the idea that French believe that they are the most desirable of all men, that's still prevalent, but at that time we thought of them that way. But I was a complete wimp in high school, and I was 6'1", weighed 132 pounds, so girls looked right through me. You can see other men. So I suppose it was natural for me to find to compensate for that by making a character who, regardless of what he was, believed he was an absolute, the most desirable of all people.
Did Maurice Chevalier ever say anything about this character?
I don't really know whether he did or not. I imitated him a couple of times. We had him sing a couple of songs the way Chevalier would have sung them. We never ever imitated any character completely.
Right.
But sometimes we would infuse a little bit of a lot of characters, like George Sanders eating a chicken wing is very much like Bugs Bunny eating a carrot.
Now, I grew up on the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the older I'd get, the more jokes I'd get. But I never realized I was missing anything when I was young, you know, because I always liked them. And now as an adult, I see things that I didn't see when I thought I was getting all the jokes when I was an older kid. Did anyone at Warner Brothers ever give you an argument that certain things there would go over the head of the heads of the audience?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we didn't pay attention to them. We always had going battles on with our producers, so they would issue edicts like, don't make any pictures about bullfights, bullfights aren't funny. Well, that immediately would say, well, gee, obviously the guy has always been wrong, so we made a picture about a bullfight and it turned out fine. No, we had very little problem. Fortunately, our producers were not very bright.
Well, who did you have to answer to?
Nobody. Nobody. Because our pictures went out with the Warner Brothers features, and they were always played in theaters. And we really didn't know anything about how they were received until eventually we would get word from the exhibitor, who, after all, was the one who could judge his audience's response. So, no, we only made them for ourselves. We never made them for anybody else. We couldn't preview, and we weren't allowed to. There were no such things as these idiotic demographics and Nielsen ratings and stuff. And the first critic hadn't been born, so we just tried to amuse one another, and it seemed to work.
I remember once seeing a short film that was a combination of kind of pornographic cartoons that some of the Disney animators drew in their off hours.
Yeah.
And it ended up getting into circulation. Did you guys ever do anything like that at Warner Brothers? Yeah?
Yeah, everybody did that. In fact, sometimes when in a Pepe Le Pew picture, I would I'd put a little salacious one frame in 1/24th of a second, and I'd actually put it in the picture. And then I'd ask the office manager to come in. I said, there's a little glitch here. There's a certain hop at this point. I don't know I can't figure out what it is. Then I'd bring it to a stop in the moviola, and, you know, that thing when you look through, and there it would be, you know. Well, I knew nobody could ever see it because it was 1/24th of a second. But then he would go into shock, you know. And we always had a frame to replace it just in case, but I enjoyed doing that. It kind of put him in his place.
So did he make you take that out, or did those frames stay in?
No. I told him it was too late. It would cost money to take it out, and nobody would ever see it. But I had already inserted it. It wasn't there anyway. But I did it to see if I couldn't put him into, as we used to say, reduce him to moccasins.
Were any of your scenes or any of your language ever censored?
No, that was left to the brilliant people at the networks, and they take out things that make the whole thing incomprehensible.
Did that happen a lot, that you felt your cartoons were butchered when they got on TV?
Oh, yes, they were, both at CBS and ABC, to name a few of the guilty ones. What's curious to me is that they feel it was necessary to chew up those cartoons, but Nickelodeon, which is a program that's supposedly designed for children, sees no need to do that.
Well, how did the networks edit the cartoons? What kinds of material would they find offensive?
Oh, practically everything. In the Bugs Bunny and Rabbit Season, Duck Season things, they would take out every shot in which somebody, you know, those shots where Daffy's bill would be shot around. They'd show him getting ready to shoot, then they'd cut out the part of the shooting, and then they'd come back, and the poor child hadn't the remotest idea what happened.
Because they thought that it was too violent?
Yeah, yeah.
And what years are you talking about?
You couldn't even hit somebody with a pie, for God's sake.
What years are you talking about that this kind of censorship?
Oh, it's true now. You can still see the films that way.
But when I was growing up in the 50s, I think...
No, they weren't.
They were on fully.
Yes, they were. They didn't do all that idiotic stuff. Listen, to me, a person who bears the title of program practices means censorship, and it are people that are too fat to run and too cowardly to fight.
I'd imagine that the cartoons that had gotten the most objections because of the violence with the Roadrunner cartoons, since they're all chase.
Well, that's absurd, though, because the Roadrunner, the Roadrunner never harmed the coyote. The coyote was only a victim of his own ineptitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that there was any violence involved there is ridiculous.
Did you ever think of yourself as doing a pop kind of surrealism?
I did some. They tell me. But I never did anything, you know, by sitting down and saying, I'm doing this for a reason.
Right.
What I was trying to do was to develop the characters that I understood and to have fun doing it. And that was the whole secret of Warner Brothers cartoons, is a bunch of people happened to come together from varied walks of life, all of whom were enormously interested in making films that were fun to do.
I'd like to hear your impressions of cartoons today, both the Saturday morning cartoons on television and the state-of-the-art Roger Rabbit type animation.
Well, of course, the kid vid stuff, that's an ugly term. I always felt that is so patronizing of children. And as I said with the audiences, I believe that you must give everything that you have if you're making a picture so-called for children. Well, I said there are a lot of talented people who are making this trash for Saturday morning, where you cannot tell anything about a character by the way it moves, but only by the way it sounds or what it looks like. Also, there's a terrible thing that's happened, is that it seems to imply that the only way that children, or, I mean, anybody can handle anything, for instance, either the Smurfs or the Mighty Orbots or whatever they are, is that if somebody comes in to present danger, everybody gets together and fights them. Well, the history of comedy and the history of drama and the history of history indicates that the only thing that ever counts is the triumph of the individual. And our characters might fail occasionally. They might be violent. I don't know what they were, but I do know that they were always individuals. Whatever the problems they had, is they were obeying the rules that Bruno Bettelheim said, and that it's good for children to read violent stories about dragons and, you know, those things, because it indicates that even the most terrifying thing can be overcome by goodness and honesty and, you know, and humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thoroughly believe that. I don't see how anybody else can, how you can gainsay such things.
We just have a few seconds left, but what about Roger Rabbit?
Well, let me give you a quick rule then. In any creative work, only two things should show. You put in work and you put in love. And afterward, the only thing that should show is love. The love should show what you put into it, whether you like that love or not. In Roger Rabbit, to me, it was a triumph of work. And everybody that looks at it says, wasn't that marvelous, all that marvelous stuff that went into there of creating the business between live action and animation. This is absolutely true. But I was so disappointed because I didn't care about Roger. To me, he was an unpleasant character. And I care about Bugs Bunny, and everybody, like last night when I had this opening at the bookstore, and these people came in, and every one of them, this one man said, God, I wanted to come up and talk to you, but my heart's beating so much because I love your characters and I care about them. You know, he didn't say that, but he said, I love them so much that I just couldn't stand coming up and seeing somebody that had something to do with them. God, that's my problem with Roger Rabbit. To me, the most appealing character in there was, among all these animated characters, was Bob Hoskins.
I wish we had more time to talk.
I do, too.
I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us. My guest has been animator, director Chuck Jones. His new autobiography is called Chuck Amuck, The Life and Times of an Animated Cartoonist. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Matthew Modine. He starred in Birdie, Full Metal Jacket, Married to the Mob, and is now playing a medical student in the new film Gross Anatomy. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mark Frost used to write for Hill Street Blues. Now he's creating an offbeat evening soap with his partner David Lynch. Lynch directed Eraserhead and Blue Velvet. Coming up, Mark Frost gives us a preview. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays the music of the Soviet Union's leading woman composer. Two of her works have just been released in the West. And there's a new home video documentary on the life and career of actor, writer, and director John Huston. Owen Gleiberman has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As people living in the San Francisco Bay Area struggle today to deal with the aftermath of yesterday's killer earthquake, private agencies and the government moved in to help. President Bush this morning signed an order for federal aid for the areas hit hardest.
Our hearts are with them as they face this terrible tragedy. And words can't adequately convey our sentiments, I know. But I can say that we will take every step and make every effort to help the Bay Area in its hour of need.
And Vice President Quayle flew over the Bay Area for about an hour today to survey the damage.
I will recommend to the President that we make sure that from the federal operation that we are as efficient and quick in responding to the people's needs. That's the reason I'm here today. It's the reason the President made the disaster declaration early on, that we didn't waste any time.
After Hurricane Hugo hit hard in North and South Carolina, there had been charges by some residents there that the federal government did not act quickly enough. Earthquake specialists in Southern California are studying information that they have measuring last night's quake in San Francisco and its aftershocks. Although there is no proven way to predict a quake, experts hope to learn more about what caused this one and what effect it may have. Lynn Weil of CalNet Public Radio has more.
A year ago, scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey, Caltech Seismology Laboratory, and a handful of other centers identified a segment of the San Andreas Fault as the most likely place for the next major earthquake. That quake struck last night, followed by hundreds of aftershocks, most of which were not felt by people but registered in the labs. Caltech geologist Charles Allen says the San Francisco Bay Area can expect continued aftershocks as the Earth's crust adjusts to its new position.
There's really no such thing as a typical aftershock sequence. They vary from earthquake to earthquake for reasons we don't completely understand. Generally speaking, though, the larger the earthquake, the longer will be the aftershock period, and the larger will be the individual aftershocks.
Aftershocks usually occur at no more than one magnitude short of or one-tenth the strength of the original quake. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Los Angeles.
The third game of the World Series has been postponed again while checks are made of structural damage to Candlestick Park following yesterday's earthquake. The next three games were scheduled to be played in Candlestick Park, the final two in the Oakland Coliseum, which also has to be reexamined for earthquake damage. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 5 points to close at 2,643.65 on volume of some 166 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a 4-3 margin. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The musical world in the Soviet Union is still male-dominated, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of two major works by the Soviet Union's leading woman composer.
In the spring of 1988, controversial opera director Sarah Caldwell engineered an enormous three-week festival of Soviet music and dance in Boston called Making Music Together. It was a tremendous cooperative effort, with both American and Soviet artists performing a phenomenal range of contemporary Soviet works. For me, the big discovery was Sofia Gubaidulina, the only woman composer represented. I think the single greatest work performed at the festival was her violin concerto, Offertorium. It's a hypnotic and deeply spiritual work in one movement, just over half an hour long. It begins with her setting of the famous royal theme from Bach's The Musical Offering, which sounds like Anton Webern's famous 1935 orchestration of it. But just as the orchestra approaches the last note of the theme, the solo violin interrupts and launches into its own complex variation. The Russians translate offertorium as sacrifice. Each time Gubaidulina repeats the Bach theme, it loses a note. She calls this the theme offering itself up as a sacrifice. Finally, the theme is reconstructed in reverse. The concerto ends with a heartbreaking hymn. The last fading violin sound is the high D played 3 octaves higher, that was missing from the end of the very first statement of the theme. The recording is very much an international venture. The Soviet violinist Gidon Kremer is the soloist. Gubaidulina wrote the piece for him 10 years ago, and it's the greatest performance by him I've ever heard. The Canadian conductor Charles Dutoit leads the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and it's a stunning achievement for everyone. The other Gubaidulina piece on this CD is her 1987 homage à T.S. Eliot, for octet and soprano. This marvel of invention in 7 movements is based on passages from Eliot's deepest spiritual testament, 4 quartets. Much of Gubaidulina's music tends to have a religious, even mystical aspect, something that turns out to be not as rare as you'd think in Soviet music. Interestingly, she earns her living by writing movie music, which she says helps give all her music a sense of character. Fascinating sounds and textures punctuate everything she writes. Her adventurous technical vocabulary makes a lot of electronic music sound pedestrian in comparison. Here's the splendid American soprano Christine Whittlesey singing of Eliot's frigid purgatorial fires, of which the smoke is roses and the flame is briars. Flames we can hear in Gubaidulina's creepy pizzicatos.
Oh,
In the Russian festival, Sofia Gubaidulina had the quietest voice and the strongest.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a Deutsche Grammophon recording of music by Sofia Gubaidulina. This is Fresh Air. This week, production began on 7 episodes of Twin Peaks, a new TV series directed, co-produced, and co-written by David Lynch. It's Lynch's first foray into television. Lynch is best known as the director of such disturbing and individualistic films as Blue Velvet, Elephant Man, and Eraserhead. For Twin Peaks, Lynch has teamed up with my guest, TV writer Mark Frost. They're partners in a production company. Frost was a writer and story editor on Hill Street Blues. I've seen a preview tape of the pilot for Twin Peaks, but I thought I'd let Mark Frost describe the series for us.
We've used the phrase Peyton Place meets Blue Velvet. And for those people who are familiar with those two pieces, that gives them some kind of a vector on what we're doing. I usually, the more long-winded answer is it's a portrait of a town, a fictional town in the Pacific Northwest, a kind of a snapshot of that town in the 24 hours following the discovery of the death of the most popular girl in school, the homecoming queen. And we meet over 25 people in the town, all of whom have some relationship to her, and many of whom have secrets that relate to her, and how all those things start to surface in the aftermath of this crime.
Now, in some ways, there are elements of the evening soaps on Twin Peaks, like Dallas or Dynasty, you know, because there's characters and secrets and complicated plots and intertwining characters. But the sensibility is just completely different. You're going for this really dark atmosphere for really offbeat characters. For instance, there's one woman who's kind of obsessed with hanging her curtains, and whenever we see her, she's kind of closing or unclosing the drapes.
Right.
And there's a police officer who always breaks down and cries at the scene of the crime. Mm-hmm. I mean, people with just unusual character traits.
Well, what we've tried to establish with each of them is a kind of hyper-realism that goes beyond sort of your basic narrative conventions. I mean, instead of the trustworthy deputy who's there and solid in every crisis, we see a guy who's a deputy in a small town who maybe isn't really emotionally equipped to deal with the occasional brutality that he's faced with in the execution of his job, and he breaks down. And I think the technique we're trying to employ is to engage you with things like that about a character and then gradually peel back the layers and show different sides to these people and complicate them as you get to know them further, so that no one is quite who they appear to be at face value.
Now, I have to ask you about the casting. Some of the people, I really understand why you used them and how they ended up in there, like Kyle MacLachlan, who was in Blue Velvet and plays the FBI special agent in this, and Jack Nance, who is the star of Eraserhead, is in this as
right.
well. But my real question is, how did you get both Richard Boehmer and Russ Tamblyn to be in this?
Well,
they were
still
both in the film version of West Side Story. One was
right.
Tony, one was Riff.
We're still looking for a scene where they can dance together.
Yeah.
We haven't found it yet. But it was actually a complete sort of coincidence. I mean, we had met with Richard first and thought he was really right for the role of Benjamin Horn, who's kind of the local tycoon. He owns the local hotel, the Great Northern Hotel. And we had come up with this character who's sort of the town psychiatrist, who is easily the most eccentric of the bunch. And Russ Tamblyn came in to meet with us, and he was just perfect. And then we thought, God, wouldn't it be great to have the two of them in the same show? And maybe, you know, somebody like Terry Gross will notice that they were both in West Side Story. So that's kind of how it turned out.
Peggy Lipton is on this. Is one of you a big Mod Squad fan?
I was, yeah.
Is that
I was
you...
madly in love with Peggy when I was a kid.
Did you seek her out because of that?
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, when her picture came across, you know, our desk from the casting director, we both sort of sat a little more upright. And I said, yeah, I'd love to have Peggy in the show.
I know that David Lynch did Blue Velvet, which is set in a very similar small town. Lumberton is not unlike Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
Are you fascinated with small towns yourself and with all the things that lay beneath the surface of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm fascinated with the things that lay beneath the surface, you know, wherever they are. I think the more important thematic thing that interests me is that idea of secret relationships and really secret identities, in a way, as things are slowly revealed.
I wonder if you think that the TV audience has a certain connection to the small town in the sense that they have secret identities and secret interests that aren't being fulfilled by a lot of TV?
Yeah, I hope so. I don't know that there's a lot on television currently that people can truly identify with, or at least on network television. I mean, the shows have tended to become more and more sort of like other shows. I mean, and less like anything kind of resembling real life, I'm afraid.
This season seems to be particularly bad for that. I was talking to one TV writer about it, and he suggested that the networks are very scared now because of all the defection to cable, and it's ending up in even more formula shows than ever before. And I wonder how you feel about premiering in an atmosphere like that, if you're worried about it.
No, I'm quite the opposite. I think given all the comment that we've seen in print and over the airwaves about the current season and the general dissatisfaction with what's being offered, I think that it presents us with an opportunity to really give people something truly different in the context of the current season. And when we hit the air in February or March, we hope that people are even a little bit more fed up with what they've been seeing, and maybe they'll find this more to their liking.
Well, you're going to be a mid-season replacement, which means when one show kicks the bucket, you'll fill the
right
open hole. Does that mean that you're going to be, you know, like hoping that one of the shows does really badly and creates a space for you? Are you taking bets on which show it's going to be?
Well, we have our favorite time slots that we would covet. It's really, you know, completely out of your hands. The network has promised us that they'll kind of protect the show because they have a vested interest in seeing it succeed as well, and they would like to bring us in at a time slot that is working for them. Maybe a little later in the season when the pressures are not quite so great. And they can introduce the show as something that stands out a little bit.
How did you first team up with David Lynch?
We met 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, on a project about Marilyn Monroe. It was an adaptation of a book called Goddess by Anthony Summers that I wrote for United Artists, and David was attached as the director to that project. And we worked together on it for about 9 months and had a terrific time, and then decided to write a script together the following spring. It's a kind of an odd comedy called One Saliva Bubble that we did for the then Dino De Laurentiis company. And we were a few weeks away from production on that when the company went under, so it wasn't made. But we just have sort of hung in there, and Twin Peaks was the next thing that came up.
What do you mean came up? Did you originate the idea, or did someone bring it to you?
No, we originated it. We'd been kicking around the idea. We have a very persistent mutual agent by the name of Tony Krantz, who kept insisting that the two of us should try our hand at television. And I had, you know, done it before and had a great time doing it, but I'd sort of had my fill. And Tony said, I can create a situation for you where you can sort of control the show and do kind of what you want, and let's go in and have a meeting about it. So we had been kicking around this idea about a small town, and without really even knowing who the people in the town were or what the story was, we had our initial meeting with ABC, and the meeting went very well. They were, I think, mystified but intrigued by what we were talking about. And we came back a few months later after the writer's strike ended and sat down, and a week later we were writing the script.
So what are each of your specialties in the collaborative relationship?
Well, I guess the writing is very much the two of us. I mean, we're in the room when every word is written. At least we were in the pilot in the first two episodes. And I type, he doesn't, but that's really about the only distinction. I mean, it's every word kind of passes, has to pass muster between the two of us. David, obviously, as a director, is, I think, brilliant. And his visual sense and his wonderful sense of working with actors is very advanced. And I think I bring a certain kind of production savvy to that part of it, that knowing how a television show works from the inside out, and trying to make it a very distinct and special show.
You dropped out of college when you were a junior to go write for television. How did you manage to do that?
Well, I had the supreme good fortune of having gone to the same school as a fellow named Stephen Bochco, who was 10 years my senior and at that time was a story editor at Universal Television. And I had just wrote him out of the blue at the suggestion of the head of my department. This was Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And said I was coming out to visit L.A. for the summer. And could I, stop in and see him and maybe talk about what it was like to do what Stephen was then doing. And 3 weeks later, I was writing for The $6 Million Man.
Let's get back to Twin Peaks a second. You don't know how much they've committed to. I mean, they've committed to a certain number, and you don't know if they'll renew after that. Is that it?
Right. It's really, it depends on how it performs. But so, I have created a cliffhanger in Episode 7 that if they don't bring us back for a season, I think ABC will be besieged by angry viewers. So let's hope so.
Mark Frost, he's a partner with David Lynch in the creation of the forthcoming TV series Twin Peaks. Frost is also writing the sequel to Good Morning Vietnam, Good Morning Chicago. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, how are you covering the aftermath of the earthquake?
As well as we can, Terry, mostly by telephone. Throughout the night and all today, we've been in touch with a lot of people in the Bay Area by phone, radio and television, newspaper reporters, as well as people who are just citizens of that area and who experienced that shock at 5:04 Pacific time yesterday evening, just as the World Series game was about to get underway. We'll be hearing from many of those people on All Things Considered tonight about what they were doing, how it felt, what they saw, what they heard, what was going on in their neighborhood, about rescue attempts in their areas, about the possibility of looting and their fears, and about the difficulty of sleeping.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Before John Huston died 2 years ago at the age of 81, he had directed 41 films, acted in more than 20, and gained a reputation for his adventurous and perhaps excessive lifestyle. How do you measure his legacy? Well, there's a new home video called John Huston, The Man, The Movies, The Maverick. Critic Owen Gleiberman has a review.
John Huston is just about the only director from the studio system era whose legend rests on something larger than the fact that he made pictures. Perhaps no film is more emblematic of his career than The African Queen. It has all the attributes of Huston's best work: wonderful acting, a story that fuses literacy and action, and the beautiful, low-down cynicism that was the animating spirit behind most of his movies. Still, what really marks The African Queen as a classic Huston venture is the reason he made it. He simply wanted to go to the Congo to hunt elephant. Huston was Hollywood's greatest renegade, a man who seized life with an almost frightening gusto. Even when his movies were artistic failures, as they often were, you had to marvel at his audacity, at the breadth of his vision. His most personal and idiosyncratic films, like Moby Dick or Wise Blood, were often about men at war with the universe, men who felt they couldn't live within their boundaries. As this documentary makes clear, that pretty much described Huston himself.
My father said, John is going to really be something. He's not going to, it's one thing or the other. He's going to really be something in this world, or he's not going to be worth a damn.
That voice, a kind of thundering bark, is unmistakable. For Houston, even a simple conversation was a form of action, a way of establishing dominion over the world. In clip after clip, he gives an impression of casual omnipotence, a feeling of being infinitely larger than whatever he's talking about, whether it's a Hollywood studio or one of his half-dozen wives. This film gives us a few glimpses of Houston's insatiable spirit. There are clips of him on the set, where he's always brandishing his cigar and that orangutan grin. There are interviews with his family members and colleagues. We learn that Houston loved painting far more than he did filmmaking, and that, according to Lauren Bacall, he never really liked women very much. In later years, when he appeared as an actor in movies like Chinatown, he specialized in playing men conversant with the Faustian intricacies of power. And according to his daughter Angelica, this was more than a touch autobiographical.
I think there was nothing my father liked more than getting a bunch of his friends and compadres, which was what most of the people he worked with were, out to as remote a location as possible and, torture them a little and have a lot of fun.
Houston's towering personality was such a magnificent facade, it's doubtful any documentary could pierce it completely. Still, as a movie, John Houston is too straight and reverential. It's an official, upbeat profile, far less convincing than the one offered by Houston's friend Peter Vertel in the 1953 novel White Hunter, Black Heart. There, Houston emerged as a kind of charismatic monster, a man obsessed with sin, danger, and his own tyrannical powers of persuasion. What this movie never quite comes to grips with is Houston's dark side. It makes his Hemingway-esque adventures seem somehow quaint, rather than the expression of a driven, nihilistic temperament. By the end, you're convinced Houston achieved greatness, not just in his movies, but in a life spent compulsively on the edge. What remains a mystery is the price he must have paid.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor Matthew Modine, the star of Birdie, Full Metal Jacket, Married to the Mob, and the new film Gross Anatomy. Also, Mike Sowell on his new book, The Pitch That Killed, a story from baseball history about the day in 1920 when the race for the pennant cost a life. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.